So just to start today, let's recall what I finished yesterday. So the aim was to define the basic variable we are going to use to define the kinematical Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. And so we introduced the holonomy, which is a function of the connection. And so now we are going to forget about the connection and work only with holonomies. So as Alessandro just recalled, the holonomy were introduced to introduce a notion of parallel transport. Okay, and it's a finite notion. It's not an infinitesimal one here. And so then we just finished by introducing the flux, okay? Because here we have just function of the connection, so we also want some function of the conjugated variable, which are the triad variable. And so we define the flux as, so the cotriad, which is also a one form, which is now, integrated also over one dimensional object, which is a curve. So we're going to talk about some curve gamma, where we define the holonomy variable, and some dual curve on which we define the flux variable. But so be careful here, because you see that the flux variable is really defined. You have some parallel transport here, because the idea is that this object here sits at gamma zero. Okay, so this means that if you prefer, when you take this integral, you are adding many small vector EA. And so to add them, you want to parallel transport them, all of them in the same frame, okay, reference frame, which is, so here, gamma zero. Okay, so this is, and so here are some conventions. So we are going to say, just as a convention, that the two curves are going to cross at the point S, or S prime is equal to 1/2, okay, where S and S prime are the parameter along the two curves. And we also consider that the tangent vector at the intersection are positively oriented. Okay, so this means that if you look at the determinant of these matrices, where here these are the coordinate of the tangent vector along gamma and the coordinate of the tangent vector along gamma star, then this is positive, and we're going to see why this is important when we are going to have a look to the algebra. Okay, because so now, as I said, we still have to check. So why we were happy with this variable is, so first, they have a nice geometric interpretation, the holonomy, but also they transform quite nicely under SU2 gauge transformation. And so let's check that the flux variable also transform nicely under gauge transformation. So we can just, the fact that we inserted this holonomy here ensures that we have a nice behavior under internal rotation. And indeed, you can check that under internal rotation, we are going to have that this is just transform as okay, so this is quite nice. And so now, so here I'm talking about a curve gamma, but let's say it's an oriented curve, okay? So these are going to be quite important, but so let's say that if we change the orientation of our curve, can we define variable in terms of this variable of gamma? So indeed, we already saw that for the holonomy, that the holonomy for the curve with the inverse orientation is just the inverse holonomy for the curve gamma, okay? And you also have that, you can check that using this formula here, that if you want to define the flux for the curve with a different orientation, okay, then you just get, here you're going to get a minus because the tangent vector is going to change to the opposite tangent vector, okay? So you get a minus coming out, and then you can just relate gamma minus one, yeah. Okay, so now the next step, so these are our basic variable, and both of them at least transform nicely under SU2 gauge transformation. So now let's check what is the Poisson algebra here, okay? Because of course, if we want to quantize this Poisson algebra, Yeah, first we want to really have an algebra. Okay, so here, when there is no internal index, if you remember, this means that I have contracted with the, so let's write here, with the basis for the SU2 algebra, okay, which was defined, which can be related to the Pauli matrices, if you're more familiar. And so we can define the metric on the Lie algebra by taking the trace, okay? So in fact, yeah, you may even take, so the trace, you can check that the trace of Ti, Tj is, so here we have some sign, so it's not a, it's a negative definite metric, if we call that the metric, minus 1/2, sorry, of delta Ij. So we can use that to extract component. Okay, so if we want to extract component, we can just use this metric. So in particular, we are going to define that Ej can be written as minus 2, the trace of E time Tj. Okay, because here, if you remember, if there is no internal index, okay, this means that this is contracted, so you can rewrite that as this, and then you just use this relation here. And so in particular, we can define the flux component, okay? So because this can be seen, in fact, as a, it's a kind of a vector for SU2, so we can, it's interesting to work with just with component. So we can define the flux component. And so let's maybe move that. So gamma j, here I'm just going to use the trace, but then we're going to simplify this. So it's just the integral of minus 2, the trace of just what is there. So what can go out from the trace? So I need to keep the Tj, then the h. And here I'm going to write that. I need to recall that here in my definition, I use the fact that the Ea was, of course, epsilon b. Okay, so here I want to extract the component J. So I get the H gamma star of S, then the TK coming from here, and then H minus 1, and then everything else can be outside of the trace. So I got the BA EBK and this is evaluated in, so let's specify where this is evaluated. It's at the point gamma star of S, and then I need the tangent vector. Okay, so here you can see that as the component J of this object times this, okay? So this can be seen as just the component J of the rotated E variable by adjoint action of the SU2 group. So if you remember the relation we saw yesterday between, so the adjoint action of SU2 and the vectorial action of the rotation matrices, okay, so this component can be just rewritten as the action of the rotation, the associated rotation matrix on EBK. and it's a component J. Okay, so this means that here the component of the flux can be written in a bit easier way. So here, of course, I need to take. So this means that I can just rewrite in a more compact way this expression using the rotation here. And I just get that this is k still evaluated at the point, then epsilon BA. Oh, and I'm missing the tangent vector here to the curl A. Okay, so I think I have everything.
Sorry?
Yeah.
How does the harmony become the rotation?
Okay, so is it clear to you that this number, okay, so you can put that inside with the BK, can be interpreted as the composant J of this thing? Okay, from the definition. And so we have seen yesterday, you remember that, so the adjoint action of SU2, okay, can be, is equivalent to the vectorial action on a rotation matrix on the same vector. So I'm just using that. So here, when I'm calling this rotation matrix, of course, is a rotation matrix associated to this SU2 element, okay? So I think from yesterday, I wrote something like, maybe I wrote it on the, then this was equivalent to, we're here. So JK.
So the harmony takes values in SU2 equivalence.
Yeah. So the holonomy is the SU2 complement. Okay, and so I think I defined this, and then you can check that contracting with a vector, okay, you get this kind of relation for the vector component. Okay. So now we want to compute the Poisson bracket between, I'm going to compute the Poisson bracket between one component of the flux and the holonomy. Okay, then of course you can already see that an holonomy with holonomy is going to be zero because it's only dealing with you only have connection inside. But this one, since the flux, you have some triad and some connection inside. It's going to be a complicated. It's going to simplify, but we need to, it's not going to be zero. Okay, so let's compute this. And I'm going to give you all the steps and then let you check by yourself if you agree, because it's a quite long calculation. And you can also find the precise calculation in Bianca's note, okay, lecture note. So here it's a matrix, okay? And so element. So it just, I'm not going to write the indices, but yeah, don't forget that these are, just to do the calculation, I'm going to forget about the indices, but at the end, we're going to rewrite that in terms of indices. Okay, so here we are dealing with the same gamma, okay? It's going to be the only non-trivial case, and we're going to see that, of course, the only non-trivial case is when you have a transversal crossing, okay? Because we want, at some point, we are going to have this determinant, which is going to appear between the tangent vector of the two curves. And you see that this determinant is equal to zero if your two curves are not crossing transversally. OK, and so here it's a point 1/2 for S and S prime. This is gamma. And so here, for the H gamma, only the part near the intersection, okay, is going to contribute to this Poisson bracket. All the other parts, since it's going to be defined in terms of A, but because you want A is going to be, so the Poisson bracket you are going to use is the Poisson, the non vanishing Poisson bracket between the triad and the connection, which is non-zero only at the same point, of course. So here, since it's only, so let's write it. So only the part near the intersection is going to contribute of, so, and so we are going to split the holonomy, splitting as, so I'm going to write H gamma as H gamma, so let's start from the end, H gamma from, so 0 to 1 half minus epsilon, okay, so close to where epsilon, then we're going to take the limit epsilon goes to 0. Then here I have the interesting, the part which is going to contribute, so from my 1 half minus epsilon to 1 half plus epsilon. So I don't know if you can read. And here, so at the end, so we go from 1 half plus epsilon to 1.
Sorry, when we calculate this Poisson bracket, do we assume, do we do this for the same curve, gamma?
Yeah. So, but so here, so this means that E, when I'm calling E gamma, it means that you integrate over the dual curve, okay? And but this object sits at the origin of gamma.
Because yeah. Usually when we calculate Poisson brackets, they depend on different parameters. So we have like gamma 1, the flux of a curve gamma 1, and the velocity of a curve gamma 2.
Yeah, but here you can already see that it's going to be 0, OK? The only thing which is going to contribute is really when you have an intersection. And so this means that you are talking about a curve and its dual. Okay. Otherwise, all the others are going to be trivial. But you're right that this is a bit, different from other parametrization. For example, this parametrization. So, I don't know if you have seen, but 3D gravity can be related to the Chern-Simon theory, and in Chern-Simon, that's true that you don't have the same kind of parametrization of variable. But here, so we are just the only non-trivial Poisson bracket are going to be this one. Okay, so I'm going to split this, and so these two parts are going to commute, okay, so Poisson bracket commute with the flux. Okay, so here it's commute with the flux, since the flux is only appearing on this curve, along this curve, and here, this one, we are going to approximate that. So you remember it's defined by the path order exponential here, but we're going to here approximate that at the first order to make the calculation. So the first order is just given by identity minus the integral 1 half of gamma S prime, let's call S prime the parameter here, A L C at gamma of S prime okay. So I'm going to use this approximation to compute here this Poisson bracket. And so I'm going to write what we get, and then I'm going to give you what are the different steps to get to the final result. Okay. So now the Poisson bracket between the flux, the component J of the flux, and matrix element of the holonomy are going to be given by so the minus comes from this minus here. Then I'm going to rewrite the first part of the holonomy, so I get a time a g gamma from 1 half minus epsilon over 2, 0. And then I got this two integrals, so the integral over the dual curve and the integral from on the curve gamma from 1 half minus epsilon divided by 2 to 1 half plus epsilon divided by 2. But here now I'm going to rewrite the component of my flux in terms of this matrix, this rotation matrix. B, A, and then I got this two tangent vector. So you see that here, at some point, I'm going to get the determinant I was talking about just above. And then the only non-vanishing Poisson bracket are going to be between BK, so which live on the dual curve, and the A. Okay, and we are done. ds prime plus. Okay, so the first step, so let me give you the different step here. So everyone agree with maybe this formula, I don't know. So here, so this the first step, of course, is to simplify this Poisson bracket. So it's just a delta function. Okay, so you get a delta function between and gamma, s prime, then a delta function between the internal index indices, so the k and the l, and a delta between the spatial index here, b and c. Okay, so then you can simplify your expression here, simplifying these indices here. And then the second step is to recognize that here you have that. So if now B is equal to C, okay, you get epsilon CA. And, so which curve is with C? So here it's with it's for the dual curve. No, what it was not C, it was A. Yeah. Okay. Almost. So here from this delta you get that epsilon. So you get epsilon C B. No. C A, sorry, of the tangent vector to the dual curve times the tangent vector on the curve. And this, you can recognize that this is just the determinant of this matrix. So I get okay, so where 1 and 2 are just the component of my tangent vector. And so here, so this means that you have two vectors, the two tangent vectors here and here between your two curves. And so you know that the interpretation of this determinant just gives you the area of the parallelogram made by these two, formed by these two vectors. Okay, so that it's here that you see that if we don't take this convention, if it's the tangent vector are not, so here we took the convention that this determinant is positive, but you see that also if you don't have a transversal crossing here, then you will get zero, okay? Because this means that you have a degenerated parallelogram, so the area is going to be zero. So that at this point, you see that the only non-trivial Poisson bracket here are going to be between two transversal curves, OK? And so since this is the determinant.
What's wrong with the curves having like a small angle, like not being exactly perpendicular, but just like a little bit?
Yeah.
So why would that be zero?
No. Just I'm saying that, yeah, transversal crossing, I just mean that it's not, you have a crossing.
OK.
All right, yeah. That this is not zero, okay? So you're right. It's not really perpendicular. It doesn't have to be, of course. But so now you recognize that. So you have this delta of this function, and you have the determinant of this function, okay? So the next step here is just to use this kind of general formula that when you have the delta of f of y, okay, this is delta of y divided by the determinant of f prime. So here you have exactly already the determinant times this delta. So this can simplify. So this means that here you just get a delta of s prime. OK, so you can simplify all this big object here as just a delta of s prime, in fact.
Shouldn't there be a minus sign?
It's like stupid
detail, but
shouldn't there be a minus sign for the Poisson bracket? Okay, like, you know. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. OK, so here you get the minus, so here you get the plus. OK. Yeah, right now I don't remember. Well. Yeah, so we have to check the sign. So you're sure that I defined with a plus when it was with E and A? Yeah.
It was A and E.
A and E, yeah. Was one. OK. So you're right. Maybe there is a minus. OK, yeah, with all these signs here, issue. OK, so then the next step when you have this delta is just to take the limit. So then the fourth step will be. Now you can take the limit epsilon goes to 0 in this calculation. And then you need to work at some point. So you will get that now your rotation matrix is for s is equal to 1 half. And so we have to recognize that this rotation is related to the SU2 holonomy going from 0 to 1 half. And you have to use again this relation. So now you just plug this inside here. And so you get finally that the Poisson bracket between is given by H gamma. So here, these are going to allow you to get H gamma times Tj. And of course, so this, you have to understand that this holds matrix component. Wise. Okay, so this means that in fact, this has to be read as J for H gamma MN is H gamma okay, so yeah, this calculation is not really fun, but so this was just to show you that you can really do everything explicitly. And that we get a nice Poisson bracket here. So now let's just have a look to the two other Poisson brackets we are testing. So of course, you can already guess that if you look at H gamma with any H of any other curve, okay, these are going to be zero because it's only depend on the connection, which commute with each other. Okay. So this is the second Poisson bracket. And then for the third one, you can either do a kind of similar computation, or you can just use a kind of heuristic argument that just the Poisson bracket has to satisfy the Jacobi identity. And so this means that if you write, so now the one which is missing, it's E gamma with for two different components, let's say AK. And if you take this Poisson bracket with an holonomy, okay, using the Jacobi identity, you get that this is given by EJ. Sorry, so here, J, H gamma, and then you get, and then with a minus, you get E gamma J. Okay. So this one, you know how to compute it. So you just get something like minus H gamma TK TJ plus H gamma TJ TK. OK, because this is going to give you, again, a H. So H with an E again a second time. That's why you have two Lie algebra generators here. And here you recognize that this can be written by minus H gamma epsilon KJL TL. And so this means that here this cannot be zero. And one guess for this value is just that this is equal to, so as I said, it's not really. Yeah, it's just a heuristic argument. But if you want to do things properly, you really have to do something similar to here. So it's quite really long calculation. So I'm not going to do them here. But so here you can guess that you get epsilon JKL. And so this means that Lie, E is a Lie algebra. Belongs to the Lie algebra of SU2 here, okay? And so this is very nice because this means that now we get a closed algebra, okay? And let's rewrite explicitly so what we get. So H gamma MN with any other H is going to commute. So let's consider only one curve here. It'll be zero. Then you have the nice action of E and you have that AJ gamma is just the Lie algebra, SO3 Lie algebra. And so the phase space here is what we call the cotangent bundle of SU2. So it's T star of SU2. And you see that it comes with a natural here symplectic structure. So let's maybe move that a bit. And so this is the basic phase space associated to one edge of a graph. OK, so here, in fact, you see that the only non-trivial Poisson bracket are when you are dealing with a graph, and it's dual. And we will see later that the Hilbert space used in loop quantum gravity can be is, in fact, a kind of collection of certain Hilbert spaces associated to all possible graphs. OK, so here we are just looking at one graph, but then so even one edge, because when I'm talking about a curve here, it's going to be considered as the edge of a graph. And so we are going to study a bit more in detail what this means to work with a fixed graph, and then we will go to the Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity. Yeah?
So for different curves, say gamma and gamma prime, do, for example, the ease commute?
Yeah.
And the ease, though, do they only depend on gamma, or is there some dependence on gamma star as well?
No, so you. Yeah, so you really need, so you can see them only as a function of gamma, but to define them properly in terms of the continuum variable, so your triad and everything, you need to introduce the dual curve to gamma, because you're going to introduce. But then when we're working in loop quantum gravity, then you can sometimes work only with what we're going to call the spin networks, okay, are just going to be the graph. So we will see that usually it's quite useful to go back to the dual image. In particular, usually we are going to choose that the dual to a graph is going to be a triangulation, okay, and it's going to what is going to be the basic block for the spin foam approach. But in loop quantum gravity, you can really talk only about graph. Okay, you don't really need then at the quantum level, you don't need anymore the notion of dual graph. But here, if you want to define this object in terms of your continuum variable, okay, so the triad, the one which comes from your action, okay, you need to introduce this dual graph here. But here you see that this only sits in the really at the origin of your graph. So then we are going to, at some point, when we talk only with this variable, you can also forget about the dual graph here. Okay, so let's now. See what is a, so if we talk about, so let's go to a given graph and see what this means. So I don't have so much time to do what I wanted to do. So let's try to give you a bit more picture of what is this Hilbert space now we have. This phase space, sorry. OK, so because now our basic variable are really the holonomy and the flux. And sometimes, so yeah, I'm maybe going to call the flux x, because in most of the literature, in fact, it's called x, because yeah, it's not really nice to keep the e, because then we are going to talk about a graph, okay? So a graph is just a collection of edges which meets at vertices, okay? And we're going to call here what we're calling a curve. Here now is just one edge of the graph. And so if you keep the e, you have the you have some EE, so really we don't like that, so we call X. So if I'm mixing X and big E, okay, it's just the same thing. But I'm going to try to keep this notation, but we'll see. Yeah, if I'm doing a mistake, yeah, just be aware that X is the same object here. Okay, so let's. So now. We will see so that at the end, the Hilbert space for loop quantum gravity are going to be the can be seen as a collection of Hilbert space associated to all possible graphs. Okay, but it's also interesting to focus on a fixed graph and see what are the interpretation of this phase space. So this means that now I'm going to consider a graph with many edges. And so I'm going to denote E, the edges, and V, the vertices. Okay, and so the face.
One question.
Yeah.
Where does the graph come from all of a sudden? I'm kind of surprised.
Okay, so you see that here you remember that we wanted to have well-defined variable to quantize them as operator, okay? And so we define function of our phase space variable as the holonomy, which is really defined on a curve, okay? And so now we also define this flux variable, an object living at the origin of our curve, okay? Where you can see that as integrated over the dual curve. But so you see that all the objects I'm talking about here are defined on a curve, given curve. So this means that now on my on my manifold I can have graphs, and on this graph, this variable, this basic function are going to be well defined. Okay, for each edge, I'm going to have a h e and a e e or x e. Okay, so this really comes from the fact that so to quantize, to have a well-defined operator at the quantum level, we look at a function of our basic variable, which were at the starting point, where really the connection and the triad. And so we smear this function on one object, on one dimensional object. Okay?
So why is this all classical construction, right? So I could have a basis metaphor and just consider some curves on this and just really calculate these quantities and associate them with certain points on this. On this curve network that I just.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. But it's just that. So if you want to have something more complicated than a curve, then you can describe that as a graph. Okay? Because you can really see many curves intersect. When you have an intersection, you just call that the vertex of your graph. And then this part of your, for example, if you were starting with this curve, but now you're intersecting here, you can call that a graph. And with an edge here, another edge here, and another edge here. Okay? So it's just that instead of just one curve, now you're dealing with many curves, and so that's why we're talking about graph. And you really see that these are the basic components for the loop quantum gravity. Yeah.
To get graph from these edges to continuum variables, we would need the set of all graphs, or the set of all curves, right?
Yeah, so then, so today I'm going to focus on a fixed graph, but then we will see that really, if you want to have all the degrees of freedom, you're right that at some point you need to consider really the union of all possible graphs and even take a kind of inductive limit to get the Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity, which is in fact continuum, described by these discrete quantities, but which is continuum. Okay, so here I just want to work on a fixed graph just to give you an idea of already at this level we have an idea of what is a discrete geometry described by this object, and then we will move to a complete description of loop quantum gravity. Okay. So now, so if I'm considering a fixed graph, then the phase space associated to this fixed graph is given by the cotangent bundle, the product over the edges of the cotangent bundle. So it's going to be T star of SU2, which can be also written as just the product of SU2 with the Lie algebra value, and this for any edge. So big E is the number of edges of my graph, and we will see that. So I'm going to focus on a more simple graph than this one. So I'm going to focus on a graph which can be seen as dual to a triangulation. So when I'm talking about the dual, this means that so let's focus, for example, on this vertex, which is simple. And so do you see to what this is dual? Here. So if I'm just considering these three valent vertices, what could you get?
What do you mean by dual in this context?
Okay. So if you remember, so I'm just going to consider another curve, which is going to be transversal where the crossing is going to be transversal with this other curve. Okay. So here, to one edge, the dual is another edge. Okay. And so here, the dual, what I'm going to call the dual to a vertex. If you see, I can close here. So here it's going to be a simple object. But if I have n-valent vertices, okay, it's just going to be what is going to be dual to, in a 2D surface, because here the dimension is important. What is dual to a vertex here is going to be a face. And you can see that in this example because each edge here is dual to another edge. And so here the dual to this trivalent vertex is a triangle. But what I'm going to show is that indeed this graph with just this variable, so the holonomy associated to each edge and the fluxes associated to each vertices, to each vertex, really can characterize really some flat geometry. And for example, this vertex, if you now add the Gauss constraint, is really going to characterize one triangle. Okay, so we are going to see that right now. So here the idea is that this phase space has a nice geometrical interpretation in terms of flat, discrete flat geometry. Okay, and we're going. Okay, so I don't really know what I'm going to have, the time I'm going to have here to explain. So maybe. So what I'm, maybe it's going to be a bit difficult to explain correctly because, so I want really to give you a picture of already at this level with classical variable, you have a picture of the phase space of loop contour gravity associated to a fixed graph can describe, can be characterized in terms of discrete flat geometries. But in fact, this interpretation historically come from is really recent, okay? Because before everything was done directly at the quantum level, and it's just recently that people are getting interested in interpreting this phase space, so at the classical level in terms of discrete flat geometry. So sometimes it's not so simple for you. Maybe you are not going to see directly what is the translation between the constraint at the continuum level and the constraint I'm going to use here at the quantum level, but I'm going to give at the discrete level, but still classical. But I'm going to give you some argument to try to convince you, and I'm also going to give you some references. Like this, you can also check by yourself what I'm saying. So here in this framework, if you look at this vertex, so you remember that at this vertex, for each edge, you are going to have a flux variable, okay? And the Gauss constraint in this framework, so let's say that this edge are oriented like this here. So the Gauss constraint, so I'm not sure we'll have time to explain that now. In this context, is just given by, at the vertex V, is given by the sum of the flux that has, so E is the vertex here, V is belongs to this edge E. So this means that here in this context of 3, and this is equal to 0. So let me explain what this means first, and then I'm going to explain where this comes from. So if you remember, in the continuum case, you had that the covariant derivative of E was equal to, of your triad was equal to 0, okay? Okay, so here, what does it mean? This mean in this specific case, so if you denote this vector E1, E2, E3, okay, this means that here the sum, and you are dealing only with outgoing edges, here you can see that this translates as the sum of the E associated to this vertex is equal to 0. So here I just get that E1 plus E2 plus E3 is equal to 0. And so a natural interpretation of this relation, before giving you where this comes from from the continuum theory. It's just that here you can see this this flux variable as three vector, okay? Because it's so here SU2, it's SU2 object, of course, but SU2 object is isomorphic to SU2 is isomorphic to R3 here. So you can really see this object as three vector describing the edge of the triangulation, which is here dual to your graph. Okay, because here, if you associate to each edge of your this triangle, you say that E is associated to this edge here, you see that this gives you exactly the closure of a triangle. Okay? So here you see that with our variable, if you add the Gauss constraint, you can see that this vertex characterizes a triangle just using the Gauss constraint on it. And so here, so the length of each edge of each side of your triangle is given by just the norm of your of E here. So you get the length of a triangle here is given by the norm of EE. So here, and we are going to see that at the quantum level, this interpretation is still valid. We are going to build the length operator as in terms of the flux variable, or at least the quantum operator associated to the flux variable. And so this gives you, so you can characterize length here. But in fact, we can show that only with this Gauss constraint, we can characterize completely the intrinsic geometry. Because so here we have the length, but we can also characterize angles, okay? Where, so let's move this one. So maybe I'm going to finish on that, and then tomorrow I will give you more detail about where this Gauss constraint comes from, and we'll see what are the interpretations then of the Gauss constraint, of the flatness constraint. Okay, so here we can characterize length. So this means that we can, what I want to say is that from this we can extract what we call, intrinsic geometry. And you will see that to get the extrinsic geometry, because so here we are on a 2D surface, to get the extrinsic geometry, then you need to add the flatness constraint. Okay, so here we can also extract dihedral angle. So let's call this angle between two edges. So maybe let me go back to this graph. Okay, so this, if this edge is E1, this edge is the dual edge E star E1. Okay? And here, and so here it's more the length of the dual edge is given by the norm of the associated flux. And so now, if you want to compute the angle of this triangle, so between two edges of the triangulation, okay, of a triangle here. But so you see that, yeah, so here I'm saying that because I can really see this variable only dependent on the graph. And you have a one-to-one correspondence between the graph and its dual. Okay, so this means that when I'm talking about the edge E, it's in one-to-one correspondence with its dual edge. So here, indeed, the length of the edge of the triangle can be given by the norm of the flux variable, where you see this flux variable associated to the edge E1 and sitting at the vertex V here. Okay, and so here I'm going to call this angle E tilde, but it's really physically it's really between these two dual edges, so it's really the angle in the triangle, and so this is contained. So in the dot product between x e and x e dot, where the dual edges meet at a vertex. Okay, so where e and e here, e and e tilde meet at the vertex v. And so you get that the cos of this angle can be written as, so here you have a sign depending on the orientation if both edges are outgoing or ingoing or not. So this is just a sign. And then it's a dot product. And then you divide by the norm of, so here I'm again calling x. My E. Okay, so here it's E. And so we're here, this sign just tells you that it's plus one if E and E tilde are both outgoing. Or ingoing. And otherwise, it's minus one. Okay, so this is just if you consider a graph with the basic variable. So on each graph, you have this flux variable and the holonomy. So here we just use the flux variable. And tomorrow, I'm going to just to give you some argument why. From the continuum Gauss constraint, you can write this discrete Gauss constraint in terms of the flux variable we just defined on the graph. And so you see that here, this Gauss constraint can really be interpreted as here the closure of a triangle if you're dealing with a three-valent vertex. And of course, if you deal with an n-valent vertex, then you get the closure for a polygon, okay? So which is more complicated. But so here, I'm just going to focus on a graph which is dual to a triangulation because in this case, you can really compute everything in terms of the length, so meaning in terms of the flux variable. Okay, otherwise you need additional variables such as the angles and everything. Yeah, so Florian, another question?
I've got a couple of questions actually.
Okay.
First one, when you write that the phase space for each edge is T star SU2, you just mean that H is an element of SU2 and then E is an element of the algebra, or?
Yeah, but it also means that you have this nice symplectic structure associated to.
Why do we need that constraint?
Okay, why? No, this is a result. It's a natural symplectic structure associated to T star of SU2. Okay, so.
And then if you have this dihedral angle between an edge that's outgoing and an edge that's ingoing,
yeah.
The E's are always defined at the source of the edge,
yeah.
Right?
So you're right. Here,
so then you would have an inner product between E's that live at different points.
No, so yeah. So you're right that here I should introduce another. So yeah. So let's consider one edge oriented. And you're right that here I'm going to have H, E, and on the source I have my E gamma. And in fact, I can here parallel transport this E using the H E, okay? And so define what I'm going to call maybe tilde gamma here, or E here because I'm not going about gamma. And so since it's a Lie-valued object, it's transformed by the when the parallel transport, you take the adjoint action of H, okay? So you get just each H. And even with the convention we have just seen, because here this new E gamma is like if you were changing the orientation of your edge, okay? Because it's the one you consider as a source when you change E to E minus one. And so yeah, this is just a question of convention, the minus one here. But here you're right that I'm supposed to consider this. So when I'm taking the scalar product here, you're right that I'm supposed to take two objects which live at the same point. You're right. Very good.
So and then you said that the graph is in one-to-one correspondence with the dual graph.
Yeah.
So that's talking only about the topology of the graph. So we forget the state. We forget the fact that these edges are embedded in space-time, and we just look at the structure of the.
Yeah. Yeah. Just yeah. Right now, you just look at the structure of the graph. Yeah. And then when we are going to add the, so in 4D, when you add the diffeomorphism constraint, then you add this, you need to recall that your graph is embedded in a three-dimensional. But at this stage, yeah, you just talk about the structure of your graph and then the dual. Any other questions? OK, so thanks.
See you tomorrow. You're not completely.